Brigadier Page, Reel 2.
You mentioned your duties in OPs. Can you tell us a little more about these at this stage of the war in particular?
Yeah. Well, the observation organization at this time was that every battery had its day OP, and during active operations it was invariably manned all day, or most of the day, by the battery commander. He'd probably take a subaltern with him to give him a bit of relief and so on, but by and large, the BC lived at the OP by day. At night, when after all there wasn't much to be seen except to watch out for alarm rockets from the infantry and SOS rockets, at night one had one brigade OP from dusk to dawn, where there was nothing you could do except sit it out and hope that you didn't see any SOS rockets or report them when you did. Then every battalion in the line normally had a liaison officer who spent the night with them, again for communication purposes and in case they had an alarm to call on artillery fire when wanted. And during active operations, you had the forward observation officer, the FOO. And he was the chap who followed up the infantry and saw what was going on and endeavoured to help them by bringing fire to bear. Well, at this time, it wasn't at all easy. To start with, the communication system was very, very poor, as I'll come to in a minute. But most of the attacks were done behind creeping barrages. All the artillery was firing on time programs, and it was only with the utmost difficulty and probably danger that you could alter your battery's fire program and call it in to do something special during the earlier part of the attack. Admittedly, say, after you captured the second or third objective and the day was fairly far gone, and then you were probably down on much simpler tasks of protective fire rather than a rolling barrage, which one had had all the morning probably, or for the first 4 or 5 hours of the attack. So the FOO saw what was going on, and he did his best to help, but of course he had very poor communications, because in those days there was no wireless, and so one was entirely dependent on one's signalers for reeling out miles and miles of wire. The signalers and the gunners undoubtedly had the hardest and most dangerous work. Once the line went dis, as it was always called in those days, the linesmen had to get out on it, whatever the conditions, and mend it. We had some very fine signalers in my battery, in 1-3-0 battery, and also in the other battery that I had been in earlier, in 6th battery. And I remember them very, very much. I remember the difficulties and the terrible times those signalers used to go through. On the wettest night, the line gone, out there used to go two of them. And I suppose the casualties among signalers were probably higher than among gunners or drivers.
Did the visual signalling have any supplementary power to play?
Visual signalling really wouldn't work. We did have things called Aldis lamps or Lucas lamps, I think they were called. They weren't very effective because although if you were up in front, you could show your lamp backwards to the battery. But if the battery answered by a lamp, of course they would be spotted by the Germans. And there was very, very little visual signalling. I mean, admittedly, our signallers were all trained to wave flags about, but at that period of the war, there was really nowhere you could safely wave flags around without being spotted. So one was really entirely dependent on the telephone.
With all the drawbacks that that entailed. Yes. What about the forward observation officers? Did you have any experience of this type of duty at period of the Somme?
I had one rather interesting and rather alarming experience, actually, on about the 3rd of September in front of Felfmore Farm, where I was the brigade FOO, very inexperienced, young. And I spent a long day in a shell hole waiting for an advance, which barely started. Not only were we being shelled by the enemy, but one battery was shooting very short on our front. For some strange reason, our line was working, and I got through to our brigade, and I said a battery was shooting short on our front, whereupon the colonel said to me, "Oh, that's quite easy. Now you go out with your prismatic compass and you take a back bearing along the line of those short shots and we will tape the battery that is shooting short." Well, it was quite an impossible thing to do in any case, and I'm glad to say the battery stopped shooting short and I was not involved in a rather harassing moment.
What's the forward observation officer's problems? So were they roughly the same as an OP? He was presumably even more vulnerable to communications failures.
He was really entirely dependent on his communications, of course, because if he wanted, the infantry wanted any help, or he saw that the infantry wanted any help, or he wanted to change the program at all, if it was possible, because his battery may have been engaged in a long program, well, without his telephone, he could do nothing. As I said, he could sometimes had a lamp, but it didn't work very well. And he certainly couldn't wave flags from the front line. Well, we escaped from the Somme, I'm glad to say, after about a month, and we went up to the north. I've done that already. You can stop for a minute. Anyway.
Would you like to tell us something about the standard of equipment and ammunition you were using during the Battle of the Somme?
Well, we had the first battery I went to, 6th battery, was an 18-pounder battery. A month later, I went to 130 battery, which was a 4.5 Hub battery, so I had experience through the war with both of them. In fact, I stayed with 130 in nearly 3 years. The 18-pounder was a marvellous gun. It was short in range, admittedly. It would only shoot up to about 7,000. And its main trouble was the allocation of ammunition. At the beginning of the war, I think I'm right in saying 18-pounders had no HE at all. They were always trained with shrapnel, and time shrapnel, properly burst, nice and low burst, is an extremely effective shell for action in the open, but it is quite useless against anyone who is sitting in a trench. And so the 18-pounders had a great deal of difficulty in doing much real damage. By the Somme, I would think that the allocation was probably something like 60% shrapnel and 40% HE for the 18-pounders. At this time, one of the great tasks of the 18-pounder was wire cutting. The tank hadn't arrived, and until the tank arrived, it was impossible for infantry to advance through these enormous belts of German wire unless somebody cut the wire. And the only effective way of cutting wire really was found to be very accurate, slow ranging with 18-pounder, very low burst shrapnel, just bursting above the ground. And that, one could say, at this period, was the sort of main task of the 18-pounders. Before an attack, one was wire-cutting. During the attack, one fired a creeping barrage. The trouble with the actual 18-pounder gun, which turned rather worse, actually, at Arras than on Somme, was that they were fired so much that their springs gave way, and so they wouldn't recoil properly and run up, which caused a great deal of trouble. The 4.5 Howe was an excellent gun. It hadn't got much range, not more than about 6.5, I suppose. It had the advantages of a howitzer, in that one could tuck oneself away in hollows which guns couldn't get into, so one got better cover. It had fairly effective HE, or practically all HE. There was occasionally a little smoke. They had a good HE ammunition, provided you had the right fuses. Well, now, the ammunition came up already fused, so you couldn't alter it, but there were one or two very bad marks of fuse at this time on the Somme, which was causing prematures actually in the gun and destroying Howes and their detachments. But it wasn't really until the famous 106 fuse appeared in 1917 that one got really effective HE fire from both 18-pounders and 4.5 Howes, because the 106 fuse was a direct action fuse. It had a sort of mushroom head on a pencil, and it went off the moment it touched the ground, so it didn't bury itself and put all its strength down into the ground. But at the end of the war, practically all the ammunition was 106 fuse, AG, with vast quantities of gas on occasions when wanted.
Did you get a large number of duds, or a small number, or what?
I don't think that there was a great many duds. I think a lot of people couldn't use 18-pounder time shrapnel properly, and therefore their things were arriving on percussion, and they had practically no effect whatever. I don't remember the 4.5s having many duds, but the thing that sticks in my mind is that one or two guns blew up, and it was very unpleasant.
What about one's brother officers and particularly the younger ones who'd come out with you? Had you adjusted by the end of the Battle of the Somme to the war, and adjusted your own feelings accordingly, perhaps?
Yes, I think we'd all adjusted ourselves fairly well. When I arrived in 130 Battery, the second battery I went to in September 1916, I was considerably the youngest. I mean, the other three subalterns, I should think, were probably certainly in their 30s, and one happened to be an American citizen, actually, as it happened. But we all got on very well together, and gradually, by Christmas, some of the elder officers had been promoted and gone, and by Christmas there were about three or four young officers in the battery, and I, although I was probably the youngest, I happened to be the senior subaltern, which was nice for me. But at this time it was decided that all the under 19 officers should go home. However, I never met a single one who did get home. I was persuaded by my colonel to go on an to, of course, the artillery school instead. And so I went to the back areas and had a very pleasant 3 weeks near Abbeville. And I returned to his brigade. And I'm delighted that I did so, and I bear him no grudge, because we were a very happy brigade, and if I'd gone home, I would have never been reposted to it. And as it happened, I actually arrived home on my first leave, on my precise 19th birthday. So all was well.
Did one have any impressions of French and German artillery? Did one get a chance to compare one's own techniques and standards at this stage in the war?
I would have preferred to say something of that later on, can I?
Yes.
Can we hold it there?
Yes. What was the winter of 1916-17 a hard one for you?
It was a very, very cold winter, and we fortunately were out at rest in January and February. In the middle of March, we were in the Frevent area, and we were supplying working parties in Arras itself, preparing positions for the coming offensive.
The routine of life in the field artillery during the winter, did it alter a great deal over the months, or was one pretty sure what one was going to do from one day to the next before the next big battles?
Well, during the winter, of course, there wasn't really, on the whole, a great deal of military activity. It was very unpleasant and cold and muddy and that sort of thing. And down at the wagon lines, one still had got to look after one's poor horses, which were standing in the open probably for months on end. So the winter was more uncomfortable than dangerous, I would say. And we had been pretty lucky at this time that we spent most of that winter out of action. But we did work very hard in Arras, building positions there. And in about in the middle of March, we went into action in the Rue d'Achicourt. And our division, the 3rd Division, took over the front immediately south of the Arras-Cambrai road. There, we had at least a week's artillery preparation before the attack, and the majority for the 4 or 5 Howes was gas shelling. On the actual night before the attack of the 9th of April, we fired more than 500 rounds per gun of gas shell at German batteries. And we were by no means the only battery that were doing this. And there's no doubt whatever that a lot of the early success on that first day at Arras was due to the fact that we had really got the German artillery right down. I happened to be FOO on that first day, on the 9th of April, with another officer from 6th Battery, and we had not the alarming day we expected, but an extremely interesting one. The first thing was, it was the first time we had ever succeeded in our finding our way to the front and being told to do it this way by using the famous Arras tunnels. And we actually got into a tunnel near Arras station, and we emerged in no man's land 5 minutes after 0 hour. And to our great amazement, there was practically no German artillery fire whatever. Undoubtedly,